produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, Tennessee drug tax struck down. A Tennessee judge has ruled that a state law requiring dealers to pay taxes on marijuana and other drugs is unconstitutional. The ruling by Davidson County Chancellor Richard Jenkins bars the state from collecting $1.1 million from Jeremy Robbins, an East Tennessee man who was arrested on federal drug conspiracy charges and ordered to pay taxes on marijuana he is accused of illegally possessing. Despite the ruling, state officials said that they would continue to enforce the tax, which has brought more than $2.7 million into state coffers since it went into effect in January 2005. The tax requires dealers to purchase tax stamps for illicit substances, similar to those on cigarettes and alcohol. Because tax information is confidential, officials with the State Department of Revenue cannot turn the information over to police. If the dealer is later arrested with drugs and is not paid the tax, he will be assessed the back taxes and penalties. Very few people have actually bought the stamps. During the law's first year, taxpayers spent $1,492 in stamps for illegal drugs. In issuing his decision, Judge Jenkins, the chancellor, ruled that the buying of stamps violated a person's right to avoid self-incrimination. At least 22 other states require taxpayers to purchase stamps for illegal drugs. In 1994, the U.S. Supreme Court determined that drug tax stamps, as applied under Montana law, was unconstitutional because the tax constituted, quote, double jeopardy, close quote. More information about marijuana tax stamps laws can be found on Normal's website. We have a link at normalaudiostash.com. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. We've gathered up some more amazing audio for you. Take a moment to join us at Normal. Visit norml.org. Thursdays here on the program, we focus on legal and legislative issues. And today, we feature the author, Dean Kuypers, the author of a very important book, Burning Rainbow Farm. This story from Michigan brings together all of the worst aspects of the drug war in America and marijuana prohibition into one terrifying scenario in which a child is seized from loving parents and those parents are eventually gunned down by authorities on their farm. Dean has made an important addition to the required reading for all social activists in America with Burning Rainbow Farm, especially anyone interested in marijuana law reform. You can purchase a copy of the book through Michigan Normal, and we have links to it right up at normalaudiostash.com. Let's begin our interview. Joining us on the program today is Dean Kuypers. He's the editor of LA City Beat, and in his third book, he outlines one of the biggest tragedies of modern marijuana prohibition. The heartbreaking tale from Michigan was almost forever forgotten, but Kuypers took his journalistic skills back into the issue and brought us this new book, Burning Rainbow Farm, How a Stoner Utopia Went Up in Smoke. Dean, thanks for joining us here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Thank you, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
For those of us who had never been up in Michigan, tell us about the background of Rainbow Farm and the community up there.
Yeah, Rainbow Farm was a campground and concert venue That was in a beautiful rural corner of Michigan, not too far from Chicago, maybe about 100, 150 miles east of Chicago. That was run by a couple fellows named Tom Croslin and Raleigh Rome. They were a couple. They were a couple gay fellows who had a beautiful 54-acre farm that they wanted to share with people, originally as kind of a camp-out place for their family, and then they were both involved in the hemp and marijuana issues in various ways as activists, and they decided to start having hemp festivals at their farm. That began in 1995. And later these festivals became quite large, and they became pretty well known throughout the country for two festivals they had every year called Hemp Aid and Roach Roast, which was their fall festival.
You know, what kind of response did the locals give Rainbow Farm?
As far as I can tell, the community there was incredibly supportive. It's one of the reasons why I actually wanted to write a book about this place, is because the, you know, I work as a reporter, and in the media we tend to reduce things to easily digestible bites like red and blue, and people are conservative or they're liberal or that kind of thing. But in reality, the neighborhoods in our rural neighborhoods especially are much more complex than what we get to actually portray in the media. And these guys were very well loved out there. People is an example of the incredible tolerance that is really at the root of our society. Is that people didn't care what they were doing out there. They didn't care that they were gay. The guys were super well-liked. Their issue, marijuana, they're trying to legalize pot in Michigan. Their issue was fairly well-tolerated. You know, these guys were considered pillars of the local community.
Now, Dean, let's get into the story here. What spawned the title of the book, Burning Rainbow Farm? Tell us what happened in 2001.
Okay. Well, this book is it's a forfeiture story. Those of you who are familiar with the drug war know how this works. If a prosecutor or law enforcement can find a crime on a property that is a drug crime, they can take the property and things like cars, houses, you know, airplanes, that kind of thing. In this instance, in 1998, the local prosecutor in Cass County, Michigan, began sending letters to Tom Croslin threatening to take the property because he was characterizing it as a drug warren, as a place, what he called a, quote, open-air drug bazaar, because when they would have their hemp festivals out there, for sure there would always be, you know, a couple kids off in the woods in their tent somewhere for, you know, who would sell you a bag of weed or something. But this was never connected in any way with Tom and Raleigh or any of the people who worked at Rainbow Farm. They knew that that was an offense that would shut them down, and they were very, very careful about it. And when they caught people on their farm who actually sold drugs or sold, you know, mushrooms or whatever, they'd show them the door. They'd destroy the drugs in the fire and show them the door. That was the way they handled it. But the prosecutor was going to take a hard line on this, and in 1999 he sent another letter saying, if the farm is used for this purpose any further, we're going to come in and take it. But quite frankly, he just didn't have the evidence to tie it to Tom and Raleigh, and that went on for years. It went on until 2001, when foolishly, I have to add, I mean, I know people in the movement are not happy when I say that, but foolishly, the guys grew marijuana in their house. Tom and Raleigh grew some in the basement that we assume was for personal use. Both of them were pretty heavy smokers. And at that point, they were probably two of the best-known pot activists in Michigan. And, you know, this is the way for sure that they're going to get these guys, is by trying to bust them for possession or in some way connect them to a pot deal. And they got them for growing. They filed for forfeiture. And, you know, as well as pushing forward with the prosecutions that would put both these fellows in jail for quite a long time. They had 300 plants in the basement. But it got worse. They bailed themselves out of jail, and when they got out of jail, the first day Tom was out of jail, their son, Raleigh, had an 11-year-old boy. That was his biological child from an earlier marriage. Their son didn't get off the bus. The sheriffs had come to school and picked him up and put him in foster care. And the charge was neglect and abuse, and that neglect and abuse, I was told, was pot smoking. This really put things on a bad footing. Tom Crosland was a guy who had made a lot of money in real estate, and he was not somebody who liked to be pushed. He was basically a libertarian in his views, and didn't like the government intruding in his business. And he saw this as the ultimate threat, because not only were they now threatening to take his property, but they had already taken his what he considered to be his son. Things went downhill from there. Throughout the summer, his mood got worse and worse. Raleigh tried to get his son back, but Tom basically was kind of sliding into a confrontation. On August 31st, they had their first court date. They did not show up for court, and either Tom or Raleigh or one of the farmhands who stayed out there with them, a guy named Jim, began burning down the farm. And thus the title of the book. Their act of defiance was they weren't going to give anything to this prosecutor. They were going to burn the place down. And they did, and it was quite a deluxe place, I have to tell you. It had a beautiful camp store. It had a coffee shop. It had a laundromat. It was all new. It was only like 2 years old. And they burned the place to the ground and armed themselves and refused to leave. So it became a standoff, and the sheriff knew better, and especially had been warned by several people, than to go out there and confront Tom. Even though they knew each other, they were just going to stay out of there. Sometime that day, however, a news helicopter flew over covering the fires, and someone at the farm shot at the helicopter. We don't know which one of the people it was, or who it was that shot at it. But that's an FAA violation. That's federal. That brought in, or helped bring in, the FBI. By the next day, September 1st, 2001, it was an FBI investigation, and they were running teams of sniper observers into the woods to keep tabs on Tom and Raleigh and Jim. And on September 3rd, the Monday, there wasn't much dialogue going on. And on September 3rd, Tom Crosland was walking to the neighbor's house to get some coffee, and was walking back with a coffee and a coffee pot, and he ran across one of these sniper teams, and immediately FBI agent put a bullet in his head and killed him. That night, Raleigh was alone in the house. This other fellow, Jim, had managed to walk his way out of Rainbow Farm, was picked up later by authorities. Raleigh was alone with the dog in the house, and agreed to come out the next morning if he could see his son. So the son was on his way out there at 6 a.m. the next morning when the house was on fire, and Raleigh was running around in the backyard with the dog. Seemed to be a lot of confusion. At this point, it was the Michigan State Police who were on patrol, and they came up in an armored vehicle. And as they came up in an armored vehicle, they claimed that Raleigh got in a crouching position with the gun, and a sniper took him out from off in the tree line. Both the fellows were killed. Neither one of them had fired a shot at police, as far as we know. So that's the horrifying story.
Dean, I've been in news and journalism for 10 years, and it's rare that I read a book or investigate an issue that I get emotional. I feel both extremely, extremely upset and frankly angry at the issue, but also it's just a heartbreaking, heartbreaking case. You know, tell us about some of the aftermath of all this. You know, first, you know, what happened to Raleigh's son?
Well, he's doing okay as okay as someone can do after something like this. He stayed in foster care with a local police officer, actually, for about a year. And I guess he was very well cared for there. He liked these people. And then he was adopted by his maternal grandparents, his mother's parents. And they're involved with the church, and I guess he's a youth minister of some sort now. And he's doing great. I just saw him. He came to the first book signing for this book, and he's a big, handsome, well-adjusted kid who seems to be doing okay in life.
And what about the Michigan State Police and the FBI? I mean, what have they said? Were there any investigations as to why these men were shot and if those shootings were justified?
Sure, yeah. strangely, I don't know if this happens this way often, but the local prosecutor there, Scott Teeter, was in charge of all of the investigations. Somehow these were all handed over to him. The FBI came out and did a sort of a reconstruction. The Michigan State Police did an investigation. The Attorney General said they were going to look into it. I don't know if they ever did anything sort of full-blown. And then Mr. Teeter did his county investigation. All of those things sort of ended up in his lap. Maybe that was a resource issue or something else. But after about 4 months, in January of 2002, he came out with a report that said it was a justifiable homicide. They basically decided that any fires were caused by Tom and Raleigh, and that the two men were armed, and that in both instances, agents and officers claimed that both men raised their weapons, whether that was, you know, out of fear or in some defensive posture, or whether they really intended to shoot at somebody, we don't know. But that was, in both instances, they said the guys raised their guns, and then they were shot after they raised their guns. There was sort of an interesting aftermath in terms of the property, too, since basically the property was the main issue for Tom. He was a huge private property rights advocate, and he owned a lot of stuff. At some point in his life, he had owned like 50 or 60 different pieces of property around northern Indiana, Michigan. He had the Rainbow Farm. He had a large mansion, an 1840s Georgian mansion that was about 4 miles away, called the Bonine Mansion. And he owned five or six houses still in Elkhart at that point when he was killed. And instead of just taking the farm through forfeiture, the local authorities there made a deal where they would let them liquidate everything to pay off debts at Rainbow Farm. Basically forcing them to sell everything that Tom had owned. And one of the stipulations was that no one who was ever involved with Rainbow Farm, no member of the family, no one who was sympathetic to their cause was allowed to buy it, which seems very, very odd that they were able to make that kind of a stipulation, but that's exactly what happened, and now it's been parceled off for homes.
Dean, I know you've been back in this community. How do they feel about this now? I know you mentioned these men were well-liked locally.
You know, there are a lot of people. I mean, Tom was a contentious fellow. He was fairly aggressive. He stood up for his rights were absolute, so he's bound to rub a few people the wrong way. And, you know, he did have these festivals where 5,000 people would come chugging down the dirt road and, you know, make some noise and maybe throw some litter and that kind of thing. So there were a few people around who had some beefs with him. But even those people, when I talked to them, didn't like what happened with Rainbow Farm. They don't like the fact that the government can take your property. They really didn't like the fact that the government could come and take your kid, because this kid was very well cared for and had nice clothes and had computers and had bikes and all the stuff that kids there wanted, and it's kind of a depressed area. That kind of thing rubbed everyone the wrong way. There are definitely people there who don't like drug use. There are definitely people there who feel uncomfortable even with homosexuality. But for the people there, the vast majority of the people I talked with there said, hey, this is a more tolerant place than what's been portrayed. We're not the kind of place that it goes in and kills people for being different. We liked these guys. They paid their taxes. They were philanthropists. Tom once bought Christmas toys for everyone in the town of Vandalia, all the kids there. I mean, he cleaned up dumps on the side of the road. I mean, he did stuff for the community. And those are people that people like, and they liked this guy. So the fallout has left, it's left a lingering bad taste. You know, things tend to fade in America fairly quickly. We're a kind of community that tends to forget these kind of things pretty fast. But I don't think that the wrongdoing that happened out there, the sort of the wrong way in which these fellows were treated, has really dissipated at all. I mean, I think that there's a strong sense of injustice there that remains.
Now, this was all before eminent domain came up, and this is an extremely important book highlighting these events. Now, are you surprised by the response that you've been getting back since the book's been published?
Yeah, the response in Michigan in particular, Michigan and Indiana, has been incredible. You know, I mean, this happened before, it happened September 3 and 4 of 2001, and then 9/11 happened, just completely blown out of the news. It was gone. Rolling Stone was out there, CNN, all the newspapers, wire services, TV, everyone, and then they all went home. So there's the folks that live around there, I can't even tell you how many people came up to me when I was doing signings and said, hey, we're relieved that somebody covered this, like that it just didn't just get blown out of the news and disappear forever. Elkhart, Indiana was a place where Tom was from. A lot of his people who worked on the farm still live there. That my event there was really emotional, and lots and lots of people came out, really, really great people. And Kalamazoo also was pretty huge. It happens to be my hometown. It's only about 30 miles away from where Rainbow Farm was. The people there know all about what happened out there and are very curious to find out if there will be any reaction from the country at large, you know, if there will be any kind of further investigation. It's a big deal, and people there are very interested in seeing this story sort of move forward, and that people outside of the area will know about it.
You know, Dean, as well as telling this story and making sure that people are aware of these events and what happened out there, what do you think could bring justice to the memories of Tom and Raleigh?
Well, I don't know that there can be anything concrete that can happen at this point except for reform of these laws. There is a wrongful death suit going on the one fellow, Raleigh Rome. He was Tom's lover, and he was very much more of a follower than Tom. Tom was sort of the aggressive one of the two. There are a lot of questions in the way that Raleigh was handled and Raleigh was killed. And the family wants some kind of inquiry into that. So there is a wrongful death suit that is scheduled to go to trial. I'm not exactly sure when, but sometime this year. But in the larger sense, you know, I mean, all that will do really will answer a few questions for the family, and if they settle it, maybe we'll give them some money or something. In the long term, though, I mean, what really needs to happen is another look at some of the most stringent and intrusive laws that are used in the drug war and the people they're used against. I mean, forfeiture was put on the books to deal with organized crime and to deal with, you know, Colombian drug lords and huge, you know, drug distribution networks, that kind of thing, in order to help cripple them. But that's not how it's used. For the most part, it's used against the ordinary people who get busted driving their car with a joint in the ashtray, and they take their car. That's now the vast majority of the cases are prosecuted. That still needs to be examined further. It's been rolled back some. In 2002, Illinois Senator Henry Hyde helped roll it back a little bit. It needs to be rolled back further, or stipulations need to be placed on it to figure out to determine who this law is going to be used against. Mandatory minimum sentences have become just incredibly onerous. For a guy like Tom, he might have gone to jail for 20 years for having this pot in his basement. The urine testing laws was one of the number one reasons why people came to Rainbow Farm, and I really hope that somebody in Washington, for instance, is paying attention to that. These were conservative, rural people. They even had like a gospel tent there a couple times. I mean, these were people that, you know, are going to be voting red, basically. A lot of them were maybe union, a lot of them maybe Democrats, but they were fairly conservative people, but they were really upset about urine testing in the factories in Elkhart. Somebody ought to be paying attention to that good people who are otherwise, you know, just willing to work hard and do their share in the country are upset about the way they're being treated by the drug war. And hopefully there will be some movement there to use this book and to use Rainbow Farm as an example of how it all goes wrong when the people try to stand up for themselves.
Dean, thanks for joining us here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, and the best of luck out there, and thank you very much for writing this book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Chris.
Again, links to purchase the book through Michigan Normal's website are up at normalaudiostash.com. Now let's take a listen to a little track from Podshow.com. This artist is a real find up there. Hip hop from Chicago with J-Dox. This tune, Contact High.
Jay-Z, Busta, or a new Jack Hustler, but I still dust ya.
J-Dox,
5'9¾". A beanie sport, a true underground beat supporter. Keeping sorta a low profile shorter. A street reporter, keeping all of my speeches in order. Breaching the dysfunctional border, I enter. Building with cats from LA to Loma Linda. Founding member of the board of directors. Plus, I got connections from Cali to Texas. You know I strive for perfection like my EP, CD, EZ, distributed freely. At least for the most part. All of my big girls, they want to know when the show starts. But see, where I come from, life is one big low-income conundrum. On a constant paper chase. Well, for that, and abstract tracks with the fat bass. Now lyric goes to waste when I'm in the place in your face. When you hear my words interlaced with the beat. Never incomplete when I'm on the street. Only time I halt and screech is if my celly beep. It could be mitrous or release. That's wiping your seed. An emergency with them, well then I leave. If not, then with my rhyming I proceed. Breathing in the secondhand smoke from y'all's weed. I'm not Tupac and I'm not
that big. Was Contact High from J-Docs, found at podshow.com. Next up today, we have an interview with Alan Hopper from the ACLU's Drug Law Reform Project. We focused on Alaska yesterday and the Superior Court ruling upholding possession of under 1 ounce in the privacy of the home. But Alaska isn't the only state in the union that could better protect its citizens' privacy. Alan Hopper is senior staff attorney at the ACLU Drug Policy Reform Project. He joins us by phone today. Alan, welcome here to the program. You mentioned in some press I saw out there that the Alaska ruling had real national significance. And what do you see as being important here for the rest of the country?
Well, there are a couple things, Chris. I think most importantly, you know, this decision is based on Alaska's state constitutional right to privacy. And Alaska, as is the case with many other states in the country, accords more protection for privacy under their state constitution than we have under the federal constitution, especially after, you know, the past 30 years of the evisceration of the Fourth Amendment in the name of the war on drugs. And so the fact that the Alaska court has done what it's done and upheld the Raven decision is incredibly significant because it may help us in our arguments in other states with similar privacy provisions in their state constitutions to make similar arguments.
And when we talk about other states offering some privacy protection in their state constitution, is it even close to what's happening there in Alaska?
You know, surprisingly enough, Chris, we're in the process right now still of conducting the research to evaluate all of the different constitutional, state constitutional privacy provisions, but what we have seen so far is as many as a third of the states in our country have privacy provisions in their constitutions that are very similar to Alaska's. Montana, for instance, is one that I've looked at very recently, which has wording that is very similar. Even California. The federal constitution does not anywhere have in it the word privacy. We have the Fourth Amendment, and we have a long line of Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have found a right to privacy in the federal constitution, even though it's not explicit. But as you know, the reach of that protection has been enormously pushed back and carved back during the past 30 years of the war on drugs. And so that's not happened to the same extent in many states. And many states have an explicit provision in their constitution that talks about the right to privacy and individuals' privacy being protected.
And when something in a state constitution protects something under a privacy provision, like under 1 ounce of marijuana now in Alaska, does that give a citizen greater protection from the federal government as opposed to what's happening now in California, especially San Diego, where the federal government is just ignoring state laws like Proposition 215?
Well, it's going to raise some interesting questions, Chris. Part of the problem, a big part of the problem that we're dealing with in California right now, has its roots in our federalist system of government, so that the federal government has its own set of laws that it is able to enforce across the country. And states are allowed to have their own set of laws that may or may not completely agree and coincide with what the federal government has done. That's what you see in California and the other 10 states now that have enacted medical marijuana protections for their citizens. the issue that we're litigating right now in a case, in the WHAM case, in the Northern District of California in federal court, is precisely that. What kind of protections might there be, even under the federal constitution, to sort of force the federal government to recognize and acknowledge state protections that may go beyond what the federal law provides for? So it wouldn't provide an immediate argument against the federal government to say, well, wait, we have a state constitutional right to privacy that protects us. You have to leave us alone. It's a little more complicated than that. But there are some potential 10th Amendment arguments under the federal constitution that we might be able to make to try to carve out a little bit more protection in states that have decided to chart their own course.
Alan Hopper is senior staff attorney at the ACLU Drug Policy Reform Project. Alan, thanks for joining us here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Thanks very much, Chris. I appreciate your covering the issue.
We have links to the Drug Policy Reform Project right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow.